Well, my name is Paul Bosch, and I teach these days at Waterloo Lutheran Seminary in Waterloo, Ontario. Not Waterloo, Iowa, but Waterloo, Ontario. And this session is called Involving All the Senses in Worship. And I want to start with a story that is supposed to be true, but it almost sounds too good to be true, one of those kinds of stories. There was a visitor in a foreign country. I don't know what foreign country. It might have been South America somewhere. But he did not know the language. But he was with a guide who did know the language. And they were walking through a city, and they came to a public park where there was a sidewalk preacher. And the preacher was standing on a soapbox, and he was pounding his fist in his hand, and he was wagging his finger at the crowd, and he was frowning at them, and he was shouting with these abrasive shouts. And the visitor turned to the guide, and he said, "What's the fella preaching?" And the guide said, "Love." Oh dear, that's the kind of a nightmare that a lot of preachers have, and teachers, I suppose, and parents, and other people too, who worry, and I think rightly so, that sometimes what you see is completely different from the message that you want to proclaim. Let me give you a statistic. I've heard this statistic is challengeable. There are some people who say, well, you never really can demonstrate a statistic like this, but I'll give it to you anyhow, and I bet it's somewhere near the truth. Of all that you know about me when you first meet me, how much do you suppose is what they call nonverbal? That is, the way I stand, the way I sit, the way I move, whether I smile or whether I frown, that kind of thing. Even the clothes I wear, I suppose. Could you make a guess?
Most of it.
Most of it. Okay, 55% is nonverbal. On top of that, there's still another percentage. It's not what they call verbal, but what they call vocal. And vocal is the tone of voice, whether I speak fast or whether I speak low, whether I shout at you or whether I whisper so that you can barely hear me. That kind of thing. The pitch, modulation, inflection in my voice. All of that is what they call vocal. Still not words, you see. It's the kind of thing that a puppy learns. You know, bad dog. And boy, the puppy, what, puts his tail under his legs and goes up behind the chair. Raising a child is the same thing. Okay, that's 38%, dear friends. 38%. On top of 55%, what's left? 7%. 7% of what you perceive from me when we first meet is verbal. The actual words that I use. And this would include then, you know, going into a new church and hearing a pastor preach or watching the pastor lead the service, lead the worship on Sunday morning. The same percentages would hold true. Now, after you know me a while, I imagine that verbal, you know, goes up a little bit, that percentage, and the nonverbal maybe goes down. But that ought to, you know, that ought to give people a good bit of thought about what goes on Sunday morning. And what I'm suggesting and what I'd like to leave with you today is that what goes on Sunday morning is a lot more than just the words, either the words of the hymns or the words of the service, the liturgy, or even the words of the sermon. That what goes on is a huge package that includes all of this nonverbal stuff, and it includes the witness of the five senses. Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, even smelling. We had a service here the other night of laying on of hands and healing, and I was leading that, and I insisted that we not have any PA system, that we turn off all the lights and have just candles, and I invited people to appropriate the ministry of silence, as I called it, because we had long periods of silence after we read a scripture, for instance, there was a nice long period to meditate on it. And then also I invited people to open themselves to the ministry of the senses, because I'd been there before in that same village center back in the Carol Hinderly days. Some of you may know Carol Hinderly, when he did the same thing, and it was so marvelous just to sit there and you smell the pine trees and the cedars and you see the flickering candlelight, and you're even conscious of the people next to you and their breathing. I mean, all of that feeds you. All of that communicates to you. And we would be impoverished without it. So I'm calling this involving all the senses in worship, but I'd like to make the point that all the senses are already involved in worship, and a lot of times we're just not aware of it. And sometimes the witness of the senses is powerfully opposed to the very words that we want to proclaim. And boy, then we're in trouble. I'm thinking of the situation where you come to the door of the church and there are people standing around in the narthex who don't pay any attention to you when you walk in the door. Or maybe there's a glum usher who pushes a bulletin in your hand without a smile or anything. I mean, you know, that's all nonverbal, but your impression of the church is formed in those few minutes, right? Mm-hmm. Remember the story of the lady who turned to another woman in the pew after the service was over, and she said, "Are you a visitor in this congregation?" And the second lady says, "Yes, I've been a visitor here for 15 years. You know, just to be hospitable to each other and to reach out and to say hello or to smile or to help to share the book, you know, the service book, you're reading the book and you want to show the people where what page you're on, that kind of thing. All of that preaches a message. And my point this afternoon is, does it preach the message we want to be preaching, or is it contrary to what we're preaching? So, there's a big word that you might want to know. Those of you who have been to seminary and other such places may know about this word, but hermeneutic. It means essentially preaching or teaching, and I'm saying that there is a hermeneutic role for the senses and for all the arts. In other words, all of the things that people do and wear and all the ways that people find to communicate, and that's 55% nonverbal and 38% vocal and 7% verbal, all those ways have a hermeneutic role on Sunday morning and whenever we gather as a congregation. That is to say, they proclaim something, and we ought to be pretty conscious about what they proclaim. We speak and we hear, in other words, in many, many languages. We speak and we hear, we proclaim, we communicate in many, many different languages besides the language of words. So, let us ask what some of those languages might be. Isn't this magic technology, these markers on this whiteboard? Okay, what do you think might be some of the languages other than words? We should probably put words down first. That's, after all, the priority language of human communication. Without words, you know, we might as well be fish or animals. But words do, you know, give precise, shaded, nuanced meanings to what we want to communicate. So they're very important. But there are other languages besides words. I mentioned some of them a minute ago.
Color,
sure. Holler out. Movement, posture, the way I stand. Let me show you an example. Suppose I was the leader of worship, and I came out and I said, "The Lord be with you." I mean, that would be one way of doing it, and it would get across the words, I suppose. But suppose instead I came out and I smiled and I put my hands out in a welcoming gesture and I said, "The Lord be with you." Isn't that nicer? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm speaking twice. Would you agree with me? Mm-hmm. Here's a good one for you, too. I'll put that down. Gesture or posture or movement. Let me see if any of you are Latin scholars. Bis, orat, qui, cantat. This is from Luther. Anyone know what that is, Latin? Bis, orat, qui, cantat. If I say that orat was related to oremus and orans, it means pray. And bis means twice. And qui is who, and cantat is like cantate, cantata, it means singing. Therefore, it says, the one who sings prays twice. Luther said the same thing. When you sing a prayer or a hymn, you're praying twice. So I'm going to put what down here?
Sing.
Music, right? Don't you think we communicate by music?
Sure.
Marvelous. Have you heard that flute? And piano,
yes.
And cello the other night.
Yes.
Oh, marvelous. Isn't that incredible? And that communicates, doesn't it? And you can tell when it's kind of sad or when it's dramatic and when it's at peace with the world. You know, music has that ability, doesn't it? That hymn, weren't you here last night for the Vespers? That wonderful opening hymn that's brand new to me. You know, my father was a pastor, and he says, any conference that he attended, or any workshop, or any retreat, or anything like that, it could be a complete washout. It could be a complete zero if he would only learn one new hymn. If he came away from a church meeting, in other words, with nothing but having learned one new hymn, he would be satisfied. And that's, I think so too. So I'm coming back from Holden Village with one new hymn, this wonderful Christ Mighty Savior. It's an evening hymn. And we sang the last three stanzas, but there was this wonderful quartet that sang the first two stanzas. First stanza in unison, second stanza they burst into four parts, and oh, I thought the gates of heaven were opening. It was beautiful. Do you remember it? Mm-hmm. I mean, the hair stands on my neck thinking about it. It was just beautiful the way they sang. And then the congregation came in on 3, 4, and 5, and we didn't do too bad either. But I mean, that is a lovely new hymn, and it's not in our book. I hope it's in the next book we publish. Okay, music. Some more.
How about facial expression?
Facial expression, sure. Abbreviate, what else?
Oh.
Huh?
Sorry, that, when you said it, it made me think of this man. We had a variety show. I work in a children's hospital, and it was not supposed to be witnessing, but this man got up to witness, and he sang. Hmm. What do you think of somebody that goes like this? I'm so happy! I'm so happy. That was terrible. I never forget it.
His facial expression didn't look very happy.
And the woman at the piano would go, oh, Lord. And I thought, I've never seen any sadder people in my life.
Wonderful. Okay, so that's a big part of it, isn't it? How about the space that we worship in? You might not think of space on your list, but I'm going to put down space. Now, for most of us, we got church buildings. But if you came to Holden Village, what, 30 years ago, you would discover these buildings that are here now, and that big building over there, which they call the Village Center, with a stage on it. Mm-hmm. And I bet 30 years ago, if you wanted to make a church, you'd have put the altar up on that stage and the pulpit next to it, and all the chairs ranked in a row from the front all the way to the back door there by the ice cream place. And you sat there and looked at the back of everybody's neck. Right? Mm-hmm. But how have they got it arranged now? They forget about the stage altogether, right? Mm-hmm. And they put that platform or the rug down below, the altar there, the lectern there, and the people on three sides. You can look into each other's faces. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nice, particularly in a church. If that were a church building and you were there Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, you could say, hey, Aunt Minnie isn't in her chair this morning, you know? Now, you can see some of that, too, if you're rank on rank and you see the back of Aunt Minnie's head or don't see it. But, I mean, here, it leads to a much better sense of community, I think.
Like the Covenant Church.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
We have some churches that are set up like that at home.
Do you really?
Yes.
Yeah. Let me just, a little teaching moment here. I teach this kind of stuff back at seminary. Basically, there are two kinds of church buildings, what you would call an axial building, which has a strong axis. And a lot of times there's an altar or a lectern or a stage or chancel up front. And then the pews are all arranged, you know, like I was describing, very much like the Village Center here. That's axial. And there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's okay, you know, to see the back of somebody's neck is not all that bad. And it does give the sense that you're marching like a mighty army, rank on rank, and up here is the leaders of the army, the generals leading the way, and then way up here is the kingdom of God somewhere. so that it's like a journey, that kind of a building. But there's another kind of building that's also very, very old. I mean ancient. I mean 3rd century, 4th century. And that's radial. That's where the chancel or the altar or the lectern or whatever is in the middle and the people sit around it. Now, or stand around it. Now that kind of a arrangement is not too good, when you have more than 25 people, because it's like leading a campfire. That, you know, somebody's at your back at all times. So a lot of church buildings end up something like that, with a kind of a feel of a radius, and you can still look across, you know, and see Aunt Minnie, but it's not the pastor or the worship leader doesn't have people, you know, behind. So these are basically the two kinds of church buildings, and each one preaches a different sermon. Here, like a mighty army, you're marching, you're on a journey toward heaven. Here, the community gathered around the table and gathered around one another and around God and the Word. And you could make a case for either of them. I mean, I think they're both perfectly good sermons in stone, if you want to put it that way. But maybe today, this is so much like a theater, isn't it? Yeah. You know, you begin to think maybe all these people sitting in the seats here are audience, and the stage show is going on up here with the leaders, you know, in charge, and you're kind of a passive observer instead of an actor on stage. Here, you're really an actor on stage, aren't you? You ever been to the Tyrone Guffey Theater in Minneapolis? Some of you? Maybe you've seen other theaters too where it's very intimate, and boy, you feel like you're an actor right there on the stage. Okay, space.
We have that long church, but we're going to do some remodeling, and one of the things we're going to do is take the pews and put them at angles.
Put them at an angle, yes. Maybe you've seen churches like that, where in order to give some of this feeling, they take the pews and they angle them like this.
Yeah.
So you still have the chance of looking across the aisle and seeing Aunt Minnie. You know what I mean? And in the big European cathedrals, you may know that, well, let me erase all of this right now. The big European cathedrals, if any of you have been to Europe, the Gothic cathedrals and so on, they're almost always what they call cruciform shaped. In other words, if you were being an airplane, this is what they would look like from the air. And then you got two big towers on this end, they got a high altar way down here, and again, lots of empty space, chairs, pews sometimes. But what they're doing in the European cathedrals, they're ignoring the high altar, and they're building a platform here, putting the altar on it, and then having chairs here, and chairs here, and chairs here, so you have in effect a radial building out of an axial building.
That's great.
So there are ways to adapt your own architecture, just the way the Holden Village people have adapted this space here, originally set up like a theater with a stage. But now they have it arranged a different way. Anyhow, space. Very important. What else is on my list? Time. How about time? Aha, you didn't think of that maybe. I didn't think of it either until I looked at my list here. But time, you know, the way we give order to time, what time is it getting to be? Is it on there? I gotta move along here. The way we give order to time, that's important. I have here a little outline of the church year, a little calendar that you can get from Augsburg Fortress. 10 cents a piece or something like that. Have you seen these before?
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's Advent, here's Christmas, here's Epiphany, here's Lent, all that purple. Good Friday in red, and then Easter, all that wonderful white. And then green, the red of Pentecost. And then here's that long green season of the Pentecost season that we're in now. And Reformation, that's red. White, that's All Saints Sunday. You know, isn't that a handy thing? And it tells you the Sunday with the date, the first lesson, the second lesson, the gospel, and even a hymn of the day. So isn't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
Now, down through the centuries, the church has elaborated the calendar to allow all this variety and show that, you know, you can do things differently at different times of the year. And you probably wouldn't want to sing, "O Sacred Head Now Wounded," on Easter. You know, you might want to sing something
joyful.
Like, what is it?
Joyful.
Something joyful, yeah, sure. Anyhow, time and the variations that come along with time, that affects people too. And I have here another chart, options for the church year. For instance, you wouldn't have to sing Glory to God or This is the Feast, you know, during Lent. In fact, it might be good if you didn't, but you just sang Kyrie, Lord have mercy, instead. Mm-hmm. And say This is the Feast for Easter. That kind of thing. And you can look at this chart later if you want to. I've got a couple of more things on my list. I've got vestments. Vestments are party clothes. That's what the minister wears. The minister could be in a bathrobe, I suppose, but he better be ready to explain it. Or she better be ready to explain why she's showing up in her bathrobe. It doesn't matter to the Lord what you wear. But you do have the opportunity to teach, don't you, by what you're wearing. So the white garment that a lot of pastors wear today, that's the baptismal garment. And when you were baptized, you took off all your clothes from the old life, even the earrings, and let down your hair. Everything that pertained to the old life, you put aside. Naked baptism, went down into the water in total immersion. This is, you know, first and second century I'm talking about. Totally immersed in that water three times in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Come up on the other side and put on a white robe, clothed in the righteousness of Christ. Isn't that a nice picture? And the white robe now is the robe that any Christian can wear when you're leading worship on Sunday morning. So the white robe, sometimes called alb, A-L-B, the surplice, back in the days of my father being a pastor, he wore a cassock and a surplice. The surplice is an alb designed for North European countries where you had to wear a fur coat underneath. So it was a great big full garment. But alb, or white surplice, have the same function, basically. They're the baptismal garment. And it's meant to show that we are clothed now in the righteousness of Christ. And the minister and the worship leaders up there, they get dressed up on your behalf. You don't have to. So I used to tell students, I was campus pastor, and I used to tell students they could come in their blue jeans to church if they wanted to. I would be dressed up for them. On the other hand, if you want to get dressed up for church, you can get dressed up too. That's nice. Fun, get dressed up for a party. And then the stole, of course, that's the sign of the preaching authority of the minister. That is, the church sets this person aside to be an official spokeswoman. You ever see the UN, United Nations, where they have the sash over the tuxedo, you know, from shoulder to hip, kind of as an ambassador of their country, you know, that the ambassador sash? Okay, that's related to the stole that the minister wears. Sign of authority. And then the chasuble, you sometimes see that too, great big kind of a poncho type garment, that's for the Holy Communion. And only the Holy Communion. And it tells you that that's the Holy Communion that day, and not morning prayer or evening prayer or something. And the stole and the chasuble are both in the colors of the day or the season. Interrupt me along the line here if you want to. I don't want to make this just a monologue. Okay, and the final thing I have on my list is...
Question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chasuble is for the presiding...
For the presiding minister only, yeah.
How about smell?
What's that?
Smell?
Smell, yeah. Boy, we don't have that on there. I was going to put symbols, but we could put smell in here.
The smell of Christmas when you walk in.
Oh,
it's
wonderful.
Incredible.
And for Vespers, it's awfully nice to have that incense going. They had that the other night too, didn't they? When they lit this little incense on the altar. And there's a psalm that says, "Let my prayer rise before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands at the evening sacrifice." Nice picture. And a church, I think, a church ought to smell like a church and not like a barn or like a, or even like your house. I mean, it's kind of nice to have that exotic fragrance in the air. Okay, symbols. I put down symbols such as the cross. We carry in the cross on Sunday morning. Lift high the cross, the sign of our faith. Icons, candles. Candles can become symbols, can't they? The light of the world. At Vespers, for instance, the candle is very important. A great big single candle in a big candle holder. In the Jewish household, as you may know, the woman every night lights the light that welcomes the new day. Jews think of the day as beginning with sundown. And they light the candle at the table or around the fireside or wherever as a kind of anticipation of the dawn. So Vespers preserves that very Jewish kind of thing. And so does the Easter Vigil, with the lighting of this big candle and the welcoming of the light in kind of anticipation of the dawn. Okay, so these are all different ways for people to speak and to communicate with one another. And whether you have your building arranged this way or another way, and whether you have music or not, and whether you're standing with this gesture or that gesture, and whether you're dressed in these clothes or other clothes, all of that teaches. And the witness of the senses, it's not just, adiaphora. The theologians talk about adiaphora. Adiaphora means stuff that's neither commanded nor rejected in the Bible. And And a lot of this is, in a sense, neither commanded nor rejected, but nevertheless, it does teach. And there's this hermeneutic role that the senses have, and that the arts and the activities of human beings, all of that has a hermeneutic function. So, part of our homework, I think, part of our Christian homework is to be sensitive to this stuff and to learn a little bit about it if you don't know anything about it. And that's why we have Holden Village. And that's why we got seminaries and courses and books to read and libraries. And I mean, that's part of Sunday school too. That's why we got Sunday school and Christian education. Have you ever heard lex orandi, lex credendi? That's another thing you might want to know about. That's another Latin. I don't want to impress you here with my Latin, which isn't all that great. But that may be worth knowing. Lex is law. I think it's with an A. O-R-A-N-D-I. Lex credendi. It means the law of worship, prayer, is the law of belief. Or doctrine. In other words, in very simple language, what you pray and sing on Sunday morning, that in a lot of cases determines your faith and how you believe. And people's theology, if I may use that term, or doctrine or teaching about the Christian faith does not, for the most part, come from taking books out and reading them, or even from courses at seminary and like that. It comes more often from what you learn, even as a little child, maybe, in your worship, in the law of prayer. So that just shows how important these kinds of matters are. Okay, let's talk about honor, where honor is due, and then I'm going to make a few pastoral observations, and then we'll open it up for conversation. Honor, where honor is due. I have four categories here. Worship, you know, the word worship means, In the Old English, it would have been worth-ship, W-O-R-T-H, worth. We are showing worth. We are granting and acknowledging the worth of God, or the worth of one another, perhaps, even. That's what worship means. The name, the English word worship, comes from worth-ship. And therefore, it's already suggested a couple of my categories here. We want to give honor, we want to give respect and reverence where that is due, where reverence and respect is due, and that includes God in the first place. We are coming here to meet with God. And what we're doing here is offering our prayers, offering our lives in God's service, and we are receiving from God. I should probably put it the other way around. We are receiving first from God, and then we respond. That's probably the better way to think of it. That God is the one offering gifts to us, and we are accepting them. I told you, were any of you here a couple weeks ago? Maybe not. The place turns over in population so quickly. I had the little kids come forward at Vespers a couple of weeks ago, and I got them down on their hands and knees like this to show the old posture of prayer, which a lot of churches still use, and there's nothing wrong with it. I don't get me wrong, but you should know that this comes from the battlefield, and it comes from the 4th century Syria, I heard some learned fellow say. It's from the battlefield because if you were conquered by the enemy, you got on your knee to show your submission, you held out your hands for the chains of slavery, and you bent your head, your neck, and maybe understandably closed your eyes in case the enemy wanted to chop off your head with a sword. I mean, that's very humble, right? And we should feel humble maybe sometimes, Lent and other times during the year. And churches, a lot of churches have kneelers where you can kneel if you want to for prayer. But you should know that this is the posture of prayer for the Jews, standing. And their hands and their arms are out, palms up, expecting God to shower mercies upon you. Isn't that a lovely thought? Mm-hmm. And your head is up and your eyes are open even. Did you see the movie Jesus of Nazareth? It's on television usually at Christmas time or Easter time. And here are all these lovely old Jewish men with their white beards in the synagogue and their prayer shawl, and they're standing with their head up and their hands raised. And it's just such a lovely picture. It's a very Jewish picture of Jesus, and it's a very good movie. You ought to take a look at it. Anyhow, God is showering blessings on us. This is the Jewish way of praying. And when you see me leading worship, that's the way I'll pray. And I will instruct the lay people who lead worship with me that they should get comfortable with that too. And it's not comfortable, you know, it's not something that you are automatically comfortable with necessarily. Maybe you'd prefer to stand like this to pray. Or maybe you'd even prefer to kneel down to pray. That's okay too. God doesn't care how you stand, or you could even be seated to pray, right? I mean, God doesn't matter. But I think we ought to be conscious, what are we teaching when we assume one position or another? It drives me nuts. I love Holden Village, and it is dear to my heart, but it drives me nuts that they have people sitting down to sing hymns over there. I think we should stand up to sing hymns. Is that Norwegian that they sit down, or? In your home church? Do you sit for some hymns?
We sit for
both. Always stand, sure.
We do both.
You should always, I think you should always stand to sing. And probably stand for the liturgy too, for the hymns and the, you know, the chants of the liturgy. You can sing better for one thing, and then you're in the image of God. The Orthodox, the Greek and Russian Orthodox, say you should always stand. In fact, they don't even have seats in their churches. Well, for some of the aged, they do these days. They bring in a folding chair. But they say you should stand up because you're in the image of God, and you should be proud of that. I like that. And I like to stand to sing and stand to pray. You can sit, you can kneel, it doesn't make a bit of difference to God. but I think when your body does something, then you get used to it. And it's hard to say what comes first. I quoted this in a workshop yesterday. The interviewer came up to Bob Hope, the comedian, and he said, Bob Hope, are you really the kind of person off stage that you appear to be on stage? And Bob Hope had a very insightful answer. He said, I did not used to be, but now I am. Isn't that insightful? You know, you play a role often enough and it affects you. It changes you. It shapes you into something different. That's why I think, you know, stand up in the image of God. Be proud that God has come to you and blessed you with Christ. Go ahead.
You said something some time ago.
We're old friends.
That I liked.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, when you lead worship, you don't do it. I mean, you know it. So you don't have the book there.
Yeah, you don't. You shouldn't have to have that book in front of you.
Yeah, and I thought that was great. Now tell us why, though, which I think is the punchline.
Well, I'm not sure I can quote myself. Maybe you should quote me from a couple of years ago or whenever
I
said that.
Well, just pick up on what you just said now, it seems to me that.
It should be ex corde, among other things. You know, the benediction, you maybe have seen some pastors, particularly new ones. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord's face shine on you and be gracious to you. You know, you've seen some ministers like that, always with their nose in the book. Well, wouldn't it be much nicer if you could have it come right out ex corde, from the heart, that's what that means. The Lord be with you. You surely don't need a book, you know. The Lord be with you. I mean, you can surely memorize that. Or the peace of the Lord be with you always. Is that something like what I said?
Yeah, something like that.
Good enough? Okay. I have even been at important services that, you know, like for the synod meeting and so on, when I've been presiding at worship, and I will memorize the prayer for the day. You know, there's a different prayer for every Sunday. And I'll have that memorized instead of looking in a book, so I can pray like this. Neat prayers. We should memorize some of them. Okay. Giving honor where honor is due. And first of all, that's God. However, we should be aware that it's God acting first, we're responding. It's God with gifts, us receiving God's gifts. So, we want to give honor to that mystery, to that metaphor, the lot of metaphors and similes and figures of speech about God, and we ought to cherish them and try to get into them and see what they might mean and how they might instruct us. But the second thing on my list is people, giving honor to people. That's essentially the meaning of this gesture. When I say, the Lord be with you, and you say, and also with you, you know, that's, we're honoring each other back and forth. Did you see the movie Gandhi? Any of you see the movie Gandhi? He would say, Bapu, remember? He would go up to him in a little bow with his hands like this. It was just so lovely. And then Gandhi would go back like this to him. I have a friend who's a leader of these kinds of things, and he says, we ought to honor one another that way. And when I say, the Lord be with you, you ought to bow your head and as a thank you for that. And then when you say, and also with you, the pastor ought to bow her head or his head in acknowledgement of that honor. Here's something that I hadn't thought of until a couple years ago. We are the Holy Communion. If you were to ask a lot of Lutherans, what's the Holy Communion? They would say, oh, it's the bread and the wine. But maybe we should think of the Holy Communion as the people who are there. Communion, you see, is a collective noun. And the people of God are the Holy Communion. And the people who are there, they are the chief symbol of God, if you want to put it that way. The body of Christ. When Jesus says, this is my body, Jesus is talking about us, as well as that bread. Certainly St. Paul was, wouldn't you agree? St. Paul was thinking of all of us as the body of Christ. Martin Luther says we are to be Christ to each other. You sometimes hear that quoted, we are to be little Christ. But I heard a Luther scholar says, no, he's looked everywhere for that diminutive, that word little. But it's not in Luther. Luther says you are to be Christ to each other. What an honor, huh? I'm supposed to be Christ to you. You're supposed to be Christ to me. And to your neighbor, and to your family, and to your friends, and to your enemy, the people across the seas. We're to be Christ to each other. It's wonderful. So we ought to honor each other. That's second. Then third, we ought to honor the Word. We ought to honor the Word. And when Lutherans talk about the Word, they mean a book, but they mean more than a book. They mean what the book preaches and proclaims, namely Christ. When Lutherans talk about the Word, capital W, they almost always mean Christ, first of all. And you can find Christ in that book, the Bible, but you can find Christ in other places as well. And, as Martin Luther again says, what drives you to Christ? That's the important thing. We want to honor the Word. The word of preaching, the word of proclamation, the word of sermons, the word of hymns and prayers, anything that drives you to Christ, that's the word of God. And so we ought to honor, maybe at its base, at the very most basic level, we even ought to honor language and words and be very careful about how we use those words and try to find the finest words and the most expressive words for our prayers and our liturgies and our sermons too, for that matter. So we ought to honor the Word. And then finally, fourth on my list is we ought to honor the sign. You don't hear much about that in Lutheran churches, but let me suggest. We ought to honor the sign, by which I mean the signs by which God comes among us. We have a sacramental faith. That means a faith that is tied up intimately with the stuff of the created world. And in worship and in our church, there are, so to speak, architectural signs. And as I said yesterday, making up a word, artifactual signs, artifacts, in other words. The chief architectural signs would be what? The altar, the pulpit, the baptismal font, the place where the presider stands and leads the worship. Those are the chief things, the chief signs of God's presence, architecturally speaking. So they have that little platform over there in the village center that raises the altar and the lectern off of the floor a little bit. Gives it a little honor. I like that. Or they have a rug, a carpet on the floor that sets it aside. In some churches they have what they call a baldachin or a baldacchino, which is a kind of a umbrella or a little marquee over the altar. In a big, big church, that is. And that gives it a kind of architectural importance. The font, I have been to Holden Village 5 times before this. This is my 6th visit. It's the first time I've ever been here, and they have water at the entrance. Mm-hmm. And that is neat. I don't know whether that's Carol's doing or I don't know who did it, but whoever did it, that's terrific. Mm-hmm. A reminder of your baptism right there at the door. That little bowl with water and a little towel to wipe your fingers on. Mm-hmm. When we went to the big churches of Europe, they all had this great big font right at the entrance for the most part, and the little kids would dip their fingers in and make the sign of the cross. It's nothing magic about that. It's a reminder of your baptism. I mean, you're making a little acted out prayer there. So that, to have that water there, that's really nice. Reminds you of your baptism. Martin Luther says, every time you wash your face, you should remember your baptism. So that's neat to have that water there. Okay, those are the architectural signs. The preaching, the reading of the word from an ambo or a lectern or pulpit or whatever. I think there only needs to be one, but in a lot of churches you see them symmetrical, one on each side. Rich Kemmerer says that's liturgical design by Rorschach. You don't really need two, you just need one to read and to preach. But we have a neat one over here. Incidentally, I think it was Arnold Flotten who carved the letters in the pulpit and in the lectern and designed the pulpit and the lectern. And he's a sculptor at St. Olaf. Wonderful, isn't he? Have I got the right guy? Yeah, wonderful wood carver. And what he did, he took railroad ties from Railroad Creek and from the mine to make it. I think that's wonderful. So, you got an altar, that's the meal, I mean table. All you need for the Holy Communion is a table, right, to put the bread and the cup on. And the lectern to read and to preach, the font for baptism, and the chair, the place where the presider sits. Okay, the artifactual signs, I made up that word, I think. But that would be the stuff that we use. What stuff do we use? Well, we use water at baptism. So I would say, let's use a lot of water. I have a friend who says, after a baptism in a church, the janitor ought to know that something happened. Splashes all around, you know, you have to mop the floor. There are some churches that are being built that have great big font, you know, almost as big as that. Wonderful. We were reclaiming baptism in our day. I think that's a good thing. So water is one of the artifactual signs, you might say. The bread and the cup of the Holy Communion. You ought to have a nice loaf of bread. I don't like that little individual wafers type thing. It's like, what, fish food? Styrofoam. Styrofoam, somebody says. We should have a real loaf, I think. It looks like bread that you eat on the table. And then same with the cup. I don't like those little individual glasses either. A common cup. It could be ceramic, it could be silver or gold, doesn't make any difference. But the cup and the bread, they are important signs, artifacts, aren't they? What else have I got on my list? The Bible, the book. Have you ever seen on television, I suppose, or maybe you were really there, when the Pope came to North America and they had a big mass in where, I remember in Boston, we were in Massachusetts at the time, and the Pope came to one of the big stadiums, you know, in Boston, and our daughter went in a busload of school kids to see the Pope. And for the mass, they had a big procession, and the Pope was there in the procession, but they carried the Bible like this. I mean, there were a million people there, and the guy held the book up so everybody could see it above the heads of everybody. Right. And it was a nice book, too, you know, red leather with gold edges and everything. I hate to see people get up to read the scripture and they're reading from a little flimsy pamphlet like Celebrate or something. Ooh, that's kind of tacky. We ought to respect the sign more than that. We ought to honor the artifactual sign that's there and make it a nice volume. Read from a nice leather-bound book. Give honor to that. Okay, I've spoken enough. Conversation. Fight with me if you want to. You can even argue.
I don't like common cup. I don't like that idea.
A lot of people have problems with that. It's such a wonderful symbol, though, of our unity. And if you have a cold or if you're afraid of getting a cold, you don't have to drink from it. You can either dip your bread in it or you can pass it by altogether and just take the bread. There's an old doctrine in the church that says if you get the bread, it's the same as if you're getting the bread and the wine. Or the other way around, there's some people who have a yeast allergy, you know. And so they would maybe just take the cup and not take the bread. If you take the cup, it's the same as if you're getting the bread in the cup. The cup and the bread. It's called the doctrine of concomitance, and you can quote that word to your pastor. Anyhow, we shouldn't be too hung up on these things. I would hesitate to get rid of that cup because it's such a great symbol. I think we should have it.
And what would you do as a compromise, though?
I think I would instruct people just to take the bread and return to their seat, which is what Roman Catholic Christians have done for hundreds of years. Now, Luther thought that people should have access to the cup, and I think they should too. But I would hate to go with individual glasses because that's just a picture of division and individuality. And it's such a terrible picture. The sign, again, I think it's giving reverence or honor to the sign, that to have individual cups is really a very bad compromise. I know a lot of churches have them, but I'd almost rather have do away with the cup altogether, or do away, people who are scrupulous about it pass by the cup and just take the bread instead. For whatever it's worth, I was at a Roman Catholic Mass a couple of years ago, and the priest had a cup and the bread, and then he had a little cruet with more wine in it, and there were more people than he expected. And there were no individual glasses, just the one common cup, and he was giving out both the bread and the cup, which Roman Catholics can do these days. And when they ran out of wine in the cup, he didn't even bother to pour more wine into the cup, but the people just took the bread. You know, they were very casual about it, and I thought that was good.
We visited at a church once where you were instructed to, if you did not want to drink from the common cup, you should save your bread or your wafer and then dip it in.
And dip it in, yeah.
So you had your choice. And
sure.
If you wanted to drink from the cup, you just swallowed your bread before you went.
That's a compromise that I
compromise.
Think makes some sense. I've seen churches, too, that have a pouring lip chalice. And you come up with an empty individual glass, and the pastor pours from a common chalice. That's a compromise, too. But again, those little
That's
glasses.
That's what you do at St. Louis.
Where?
St. Louis College.
But that common cup and the common loaf, too, they are such important symbols. I would hate to see them, you know, I would hate to see them disappear. Something more? We have a few more minutes.
You then would use leavened bread?
Well, there's two traditions in the church, and it's good to know about that too, I suppose. The Orthodox have always used leavened bread, bread with yeast in it. The Roman Church and the Western Church, which we're in a sense derivative of, they have used unleavened bread. So you can kind of pay your money and take your choice. I don't think it makes a lot of difference. Maybe you want to have unleavened bread during Lent and leavened bread during Easter.
That's what we've always done.
Oh, really? You changed the kind of bread?
Well, not where I am now. It's too big a fight. But
right.
In Jackson and Northfield.
Really?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
During the leavened season and during the unleavened season.
Yeah. St. Paul talks about the new leaven having to do with the Passover, of course, and then in some churches, they make a big thing out of blessing the, again, this would be more Orthodox, blessing the new yeast, the new loaf. The housewife brings the loaf on Easter morning to be blessed. Don't be shy.
One of the languages we did not list was the language of dance.
Dance, yes.
A history in the, especially the Jewish community. But we have very few Lutherans that are trained to dance liturgically.
Yeah.
Can you comment on whether seminaries are trying to offer courses in that, or are there other places that are offering training in dance? Mm-hmm. I don't think very many of us want some kinds of dance in our worship, but
every now and then it's sure effective, isn't it? Boy, did you see the mime the other night? Wasn't she good? Oh, she was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen services, as you may have too, where they've had a troupe of dancers that just, oh my goodness, it is so moving and so effective. It really gets you. I mean, it can be very lovely and very beautifully done. I don't know of seminary courses as such in liturgical dance, but I bet every major city ought to have some people who do this kind of thing on special occasions, and seminaries should tap into that. And we had a workshop, for instance, in liturgical dance at our seminary last year, and I hope we can have another one next year. Again, people, every Christian ought to be comfortable in your body and with your own body. And then to have the specially trained people who can do that so beautifully, oh, it just chokes me up. Quite frankly, I may have been like you. A couple years ago, I had never seen it. And I thought, liturgical dance, dance in church, I'm not sure I'm going to like this. And I went anyhow, and it just blew me away. I mean, it was marvelous. And from that day, I was converted. And it was wonderful.
It has to be well done.
Right? But it has to be well done, right? And discreetly done, and you don't want to offend pieties and so on. Mm-hmm. Probably good to do it at a special service rather than on Sunday morning, at least first. Mm-hmm. And after people get used to it, then introduce it on Sunday morning.
A few years ago, they had a Vespers here. I don't know if you saw it. That was all dance.
Oh, really?
The lights were out, and the dancers came in at angles, you know, the way the seats are. Mm-hmm. And it was all young women in the flowing robes and bare feet, and they had scarves, and they just used colored lights on them. And the whole Vespers was quiet, and it was only dance.
I bet it was wonderful.
It was. Yeah. I've never forgotten it.
That speaks to you. There's no question about it. Well, we better quit. Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you. Thank you.